You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The United States is now 5 years into what's come to be known as the Great Recession, and while our economy has begun to show signs of life in terms of job creation, a true recovery has been slow in developing. Out this week in paperback with a new preface is End This Depression Now, Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman's examination of the state of the global economy and what he feels is needed here and abroad for a strong recovery. Mr. Krugman, a professor of economics at Princeton University and op-ed columnist for the New York Times, argues that it is well within Washington's power to get our economy back on track and put an end to this now lengthy crisis. And I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show.
Hi there. Good to be on.
You were here for the hardcover edition. Yeah. Do you feel a lot has changed in the last 9 months?
Well, the economic news is somewhat better. So, you know, things are now improving instead of simply drifting or getting worse more slowly, which was all you could really say before. And the political discourse has improved from my point of view as well, with the people who've been aggressively pushing exactly the wrong policies seem to be losing their grip. But we're a long way from the kind of remedy that I've been pushing for.
It's also been pointed out that the people who disagree with you in Congress are pretty much all in safe seats. So this debate is going to go on for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know quite what is a safe seat, but no, there will be no major.
Well, redistricting has made it possible for some people to be almost assured that their party will always win
seat. If House representation was based on the popular vote, we would now have a Democratic House, and there would be at least a reasonable chance of actually getting a stimulus bill even now, but it's not. It isn't, and so that's not. So you push for what's right, and you push for what's possible, and those aren't necessarily entirely the same thing.
Now, in fact, five or six state legislatures are now looking for some similar approach to the Electoral College, and I wonder how the public responds to something like that. Do they see it as cheating?
I think so. It actually looks, and this is not my field of expertise at all, but it looks as if the attempts to, you know, use voter identification theft to suppress the vote actually backfired in this last election. That particularly the African American community, they know from that. They've been through a century and a half of that, and they actually mobilized. So it actually ended up probably that the attempts to cheat in this election, this last election, ended up working to the Democrats' advantage, and that might be true in this case as well.
Well, let's go to your area of expertise, and perhaps the thing that has caused the most heat in this discussion. Can you take us through your argument as to why the deficit should not be at the top of the list of things the federal government should be worried about?
Okay, so there's two things. One is to understand just how much economic damage is done by trying to cut the deficit at a time like this. Because the fundamental point is an economy is not like a family. An economy, if an individual family says, oh, we've got to spend less, that's fine. But if everybody tries to spend less at the same time, then you have this problem, which is that my spending is your income, your spending is my income. And if we all try to spend less at the same time, what we get is a depression, which makes everybody worse off. And we are in normal times, there's enough strength in the economy that you can deal with that. The Federal Reserve can cut interest rates, and that will help offset any cuts in government spending. But right now, interest rates are at zero. You can't do that. So right now, cutting spending makes the economy worse. You don't expect families to base their decisions on that, but the government should not be doing this. The government should not be making the depression deeper. So this is a really bad time to cut government spending. Now you say, well, don't we have a deficit crisis? What about debt? Well, certainly we have a deficit. It's large. Government debt is growing. Eventually you want to do something about that, but not now. And there's no hint of a crisis in the numbers, right? People say we have a debt crisis. If that was true, how come the federal government can borrow at less than 2% interest rates?
Well, there are people who disagree with you, people who have some respect in the world. Richard Haass, the Council on Foreign Relations president, former Joint Chief Chairman Michael Mullen, argued that the long-term debt poses the greatest threat to America's national security. Mr. Haass takes exception to your suggestion that deficits don't matter and that long-term debt can be pushed to the side for years to come. Mr. Haas, Admiral Mullen, and also the former Clinton chief of staff, Erskine Bowles, all believe that entitlements and debt are the most pressing challenges we face as a country over the next few decades.
Yeah, well, the two questions. You want to ask, okay, on what basis do they make that judgment? And if you actually look at reasonable projections for debt over the next 10 years, they are not especially alarming. The 10-year prospect for debt is that even if we do nothing more, even if we have no further deficit reduction measures, it will rise only modestly as a share of GDP, which is the way you want to count it. You always want to scale it by the size of the economy. So it doesn't look like a crisis. The markets obviously don't think it's a crisis. Then, yeah, there are some – we think that there will be large imbalances between spending and revenue 15, 20 years from now. But why exactly do we have to deal with that now? No one has given a good explanation of why it has to be done urgently. And in terms of the authority, look, the what I call the deficit scolds, they call themselves deficit hawks, but I think scolds is a better term. They've made a lot of predictions. They've been telling us that we're going to have a financial crisis, that the bond market is going to turn on us any day now, and they've been saying that for about 4 years. Right? At what point do we say, hey, maybe you have the wrong model?
And I do remember very early in my career here at WNYC, I've been here for nearly 28 years, people coming on and talking about how Social Security was going to go broke within 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
And that was a long time ago.
That's right. Social Security, you know, it's true that measures were taken to shore up Social Security finances back in the mid-1980s. Fine. But that shows that we can actually do stuff when it becomes necessary. And this is – I think it's very important to say that we've actually had a test of rival views of the economy. Starting as soon as Barack Obama took office or even before, a lot of the same people who are saying, oh, deficits are the key problem, were predicting an imminent surge in U.S. borrowing costs, an imminent surge in inflation. People like me were saying, no, that's not going to happen under current conditions. How, you know, we've got a lot of evidence under our belt at this point.
But you say that we can put off really dealing with the debt problem to sometime in the future. Some have argued that not dealing directly with the deficit today is analogous to not dealing directly with climate change. And
there's a huge difference. I think if that's – I like to talk about that analogy because I think it gets at the heart of what is not the problem. Every year that we don't deal with climate change, we're putting 35 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So we're exerting a major physical impact that we'll be paying for generations by not dealing with it now. When we talk about these deficit debt issues, no one is actually proposing that we start paying down debt right now. So all they're talking about, all that's on the table in these proposals is that we preemptively cut Social Security benefits, Medicare benefits for – not for now, but for 10 years from now, 15 years from now. The danger, supposedly, is that we won't have enough revenue to pay for future benefits, so we'll be forced to cut benefits. So they're saying we must urgently move to cut future benefits in order to avoid future cuts in benefits. It doesn't actually – the argument doesn't actually hang together. And it's totally different. There's nothing corresponding to those vast, you know, to the pollution that we're spewing out by not dealing with climate change right now.
Well, they're saying we're just passing on the bill to our children and grandchildren.
But they're proposing to do the same thing. They're proposing to pass the bill on to people 15, 20, 30 years from now. They're just proposing that we decide right now exactly who's going to pay the bill. And, you know, you can make some argument for that, but it hardly seems like an urgent priority.
My guest is Paul Krugman, whose latest book, End This Depression Now, has just been released in a paperback edition by W.W. Norton with a new preface. You've been talking about spending. The infrastructure is in desperate need of repair and rebuilding, and there are millions of people looking for work. What is standing in the way of a major public works initiative similar to the ones that we had during the Depression and during the Eisenhower administration?
Yeah, it's totally political and ideological.
But Eisenhower was a Republican president.
Yeah, but
we built all of our
highways.
Yeah,
Abraham Lincoln was a Republican too. I mean, the parties change, right? That was an entirely different party. Remember, Eisenhower was a Republican who presided over a top tax rate of 91%. So things have changed a bit. No, and what you have is an enormous hostility to government spending, an enormous hostility to any notion that the government can serve a productive role. A lot of infrastructure projects actually, I believe that if you look at the political debate, anything that involves public transportation, there's active hostility, not just that they don't want to spend the money, but they just hate the idea of improving public transportation. So
why?
Well, because it's public, because you know, what kind of people ride public transportation? Well, urban types who vote Democrat. I don't know. You read some, you know, read a George Will column about how much he hates trains, and it's not about anything that you and I would recognize as cost benefit analysis.
I guess he's never taken that train from Rome to Florence. It's really fabulous.
Actually, he's taken the train. I've seen him get off the train from Washington to New York. But anyway, but still. So there's. But anyway, the point is that there is. It's clear that there was a lot of – well, look, when Governor Christie canceled the much-needed rail tunnel under the Hudson, it was clear he was looking for some reason to cancel it. The arguments for continuing with the project were overwhelming. He was just itching to find some way to eliminate this particular project.
Well, high-speed rail is still controversial in this country. Some people feel that it wouldn't work as well as it does in Europe or in Japan, or I guess China's put a lot of money into it, but they have a pretty problematical program right now.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually, if we're going to get into these things, high-speed rail is nice, but what we really need, what we have is a lot of actually very low-speed rail. If you look at the Northeast Corridor, there are places where the trains really need to slow down because we need pretty basic improvements, but mundane improvements. So I would say a first priority if we're going to do that. This is not, you know, I'm not a transportation expert, but my understanding is that a relatively modest sum spent on eliminating some of those bottlenecks would do a huge amount for train service in this part of America.
Now, we're getting comments from our listeners, questions that they're asking. I probably should address a few of them before it gets too late. Shangar from Hillsborough, New Jersey, wonders if deficit spending is appropriate since Americans buy so much that's manufactured overseas. He understands it working if we made what we bought here, but we don't.
Well, okay. First of all, what I would like us to do, first thing first, the most obvious things to do are to rehire the hundreds of thousands of school teachers who have been laid off, and we're not going to be hiring them from China, and to resume all of the pretty small-scale infrastructure projects that have been put on ice because of problems at the state and local level. Again, the construction workers are not going to be coming from China. Even to the extent that we're buying manufactured goods, it may say made in China, but when you buy a Chinese product at Walmart, most of the price you pay is actually domestic value. It's domestic distribution, domestic retailing, and so on. So I won't say there's nothing to that concern, but it's a lot smaller than people think.
And Charles from Oyster Bay, Long Island, writes, if the world economy rebounds, investment opportunities grow, won't the United States government's borrowing costs go up? What can we expect? Will the Treasury deal with that?
Sure. The U.S. will have higher borrowing costs, although remember, we can lock in borrowing at low interest rates long term, right? We can sell 30-year bonds at very low interest rates right now, or certainly 10-year bonds. But also, if the economy recovers, it's true that the borrowing costs will go up, but so will revenues. Most of our deficit would probably go away in a recovered economy. So yeah, we'd be paying more interest on what we have to borrow, but that's a trade-off that I think we would happily take, even in fiscal terms.
My guest is Paul Krugman, professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School and centenary professor at the London School of Economics. He's also an op-ed columnist and blogger for the New York Times. His columns appear twice a week. And he is the a Nobel laureate. His latest book is called End This Depression Now. It was released in hardcover 9 months ago, and now it's in paperback from W.W. Norton with a new preface. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with Paul Krugman, Nobel laureate and op-ed columnist and author of how many books?
I have no idea. 20-something.
Stop counting. The last one, End This Depression Now, is now available in paperback with a new preface from W.W. Norton. People have been writing in about the Obama administration, so maybe we should address the Obama policies. What do you make of the Obama – this person writes, what do you make of the Obama administration's attitude toward Wall Street? Many of the banks remain too big to fail. Not a single Wall Street executive has been prosecuted for the financial crisis.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear, at least my view is that Obama went way too easy on Wall Street. I understand that in those first 6 months that they were very concerned about confidence, but I think they were too worried about confidence. That the important thing was making it clear that there was a federal backstop for the banking system, which they did. But then within that, they could have done some prosecutions. They could have cracked down. I still think we would, in the end, have been better off if they had nationalized temporarily one or two of the biggest banks. So it's a failing. I don't think that's I'm not sure that's the most important failing. That I think the underpowered stimulus and the failure to have an effective mortgage relief policy were bigger mistakes.
Assuming Jack Lew, President Obama's nominee for Treasury Secretary, is confirmed, do you think that the administration's policy toward big banks and Wall Street will differ much from the first term?
I think they are toughening up. The sense I get is they're toughening up, that the Consumer Financial Products Bureau is, in fact, looking like it has teeth, and rather helpfully, Wall Street, which is ordinarily at least somewhat balanced between the parties, went all in for Mitt Romney. So they don't have the kind of political capital they did before. And I'm hopeful that we'll actually see a tougher policy.
But Jack Lew said in 2009 hearing during that the problems of the financial industry preceded deregulation and added, I don't believe that deregulation was the proximate cause of the financial crisis.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate because I would say that deregulation was a symptom of a broader phenomenon. So I would say that we had this general loss of sense of risk, and deregulation was in a way part of this ongoing spirit of the times where everybody thought it was that Wild West finance was fine. So it wasn't that you can specifically say, oh, ending of Glass-Steagall caused the crisis. It was just one of a bunch of things. And that's the way to defend what Lew said. But still, I wish he had but on the other hand, he supposedly has WPA art on the walls of his office, which makes me feel a lot better about him.
Did anything in President Obama's inaugural address give you hope that he understands what's needed for the federal government to strengthen the economy?
Yeah. The most important thing was what he didn't say. He said very little. He's only mentioned the deficit once. It was not a deficit hawk, grand bargain, this is the biggest problem we face speech. It was very much, it's what we need is public investment, what we need is to. So that the second inaugural I liked a whole lot better than the first inaugural.
Now, Paul Ryan took it personally. He said the president was setting up straw men, although that was probably an inaccurate metaphor. But still, he saw it as him being the straw man.
Well, yeah. I mean, Paul Ryan, in a lot of ways, he's not a straw man. He's the living, breathing, double-talking embodiment of everything that's wrong with the Republican point of view on economic policy. So it's good if the president was bashing him implicitly.
But given the reality of Washington, of this split Congress, is there much that can be done?
No. Look, I would like to see a $300 billion package of aid to state and local governments. I'd like to see some new infrastructure spending, all kinds of things, none of which is going to happen certainly in the next 2 years, and probably not for the next four unless there's a miracle in the midterm election. So we know that.
And we saw that with the debate over legislation to pay for disaster relief in the wake of Hurricane Sandy, where some members of Congress wanted to offset any expenditures with equal cuts and other types of government spending.
Yeah. So the reality is we're not going to have positive, active policies for at least the next 2 years. But we can at least avoid doing damage. We can avoid gratuitous austerity. We can avoid giving away the store on the entitlements program. So I'm relatively hopeful. Since I think the economy is recovering, not as fast as it should, but it is recovering, at least I'm more optimistic that Obama won't let Washington screw this up.
Well, you seem to be suggesting that the real issue is the creation of jobs.
Yeah.
And Joseph Stiglitz, who usually agrees with you, seems to think that the problem is income inequality.
Yeah. So
are they related?
I think my disagreement with Joe, and it's not an important disagreement, I think you could say. This was an analytical discussion between two bearded economists, right? I think he and I both agree that our wildly unequal society played an important role in the lead-up to the financial crisis, that both the enormous rewards for being a bad actor on Wall Street and the political power of the wealthy helped to get us into the mess. Joe is arguing that inequality is a current big reason why we don't have enough spending in the economy, and I don't think that's right. It's a fairly technical argument, but I would say that the burst housing bubble, the overhang of consumer debt that came out of the housing bubble, those are the factors standing in the way. And much as I think inequality is a blight on our society, I don't agree that that's an important reason why growth has been slow in the past 2 years.
You've been writing a lot about the idea that we heard from Mitt Romney and others, in fact, just recently from Paul Ryan about the makers and the takers.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. So the I'm delighted to see it so much out in the open, this right-wing view that there's actually a fairly small number of productive people who are carrying, Atlas carrying the world on his shoulders, who are carrying everybody else, and that large fractions of the American public are mooching off this wealth. And it's not true.
The president addressed it in his
inaugural. That's right, and as well he should, that we have Social Security and we have Medicare, which are good programs that make our lives a little bit more secure. They talk about means-tested programs have grown. Who are all these people? Well, we can actually figure that out. It's children and low-income workers who are getting the earned income tax credit. You really saying those people are not deserving?
Well, when Paul Ryan said 60% of the country, he was talking about people on Social Security as well. And I remember the Tea Party members who were complaining that they thought that Social Security and their Medicare was going to be taken from them.
That's right.
But there are still all of these plans that are floated for privatizing both.
Yeah, and in a way, it's a con game that's being practiced, more than in a way. There's a lot of people out there who think that government is taking from them to give to those people and don't realize that actually what the bulk of government spending on transfer payments is Social Security and Medicare, which they count on. So they're imagining you can throw the bums off welfare, even though there really aren't very many bums on welfare at this point.
Well, but this has been a debate that goes back a long time, way before Ronald Reagan talked about the welfare queens.
Yeah, and look, there was.
The Do you main think thing that there's some other kind of code that's going on there?
I actually think the Republicans have lost the thread here. What was code for taking away from people who are not white has turned into a sort of code where the way they talk among themselves is that everybody receiving Social Security and Medicare or Medicaid, which in many cases is middle-class people, is somehow a moocher, and that doesn't resonate anymore. So I think they've lost touch with what they were. They've started to not hear their own dog whistle, I guess is the way to put it.
My guest is Paul Krugman. His latest book is now available in paperback, and This Depression Now, available from W.W. Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Patrick on Twitter would like you to elaborate on the talking points that equate government spending with family spending.
Okay. I mean, again, the critical thing is that an individual family doesn't have to worry about how its spending decisions affect its own job prospects. You know, if I, as the head of household, decide that we're going to cancel a family vacation, I don't worry that that's going to make my son-in-law lose his job. But at a national level, you absolutely do have to worry about that. At a national level, if the government says, okay, we're going to slash unemployment benefits, even though lots of people still desperately need them because we need to save money, you're going to make those people poorer, they're going to spend less, the economy is going to shrink, your tax revenue is going to go down. There's a tremendous amount of backwash onto you, and it's a terribly wrong analogy to think of the government as being like a family. It's not. The government has to think about a lot more, and the government needs to play an active role in managing the economy in a way that a family does not.
Vic from Chester, New Jersey, says if the government can't pay for social programs any longer, do you see the private sector taking on a greater role in providing those services?
Now, first of all, the premise is wrong. Government is not having any problem right now paying for social programs. Once the economy recovers, best prospect, the best estimates don't suggest any serious fiscal problems over the next decade. And of course, there is this thing, you know, we could raise more revenue. We could look for ways to reduce healthcare costs. There's nothing at all to say that the social insurance programs are unsustainable.
What about printing more money?
Well, you can do that now because it's
so the Weimar Republic suffered from that.
But there's an enormous gap between printing some money while the economy is deeply depressed, when in fact printing money is not inflationary, to run away. I actually wanted some kind of rule. There's this rule that says the first person to bring up Hitler in a debate has lost the debate. I think that the first person to bring up either Weimar or Zimbabwe should be considered to have lost the debate. It's just not relevant now.
Well, since we're talking about other countries, globalization is here to stay. And how much of the problems in Europe, the effect of the problems in Europe, affects the U.S. economy? And this is something that we have little control over.
Yeah. Let me say, first of all, globalization, it could be reversed. It's not. There is a.
Have
but
you
that's,
spoken
that's
to your colleague
point.
Tom Friedman?
History shows it has its ups and downs. But anyway, that's not the important point. The important point is that by the numbers, our dependence on what happens in Europe is a lot less than people imagine. Of course, it's there, but we only sell about 2% of U.S. GDP to Europe. So even a severe recession in Europe has only a modest impact on our economy directly. Obviously, to the extent that we're financially intertwined, it might weaken our banks, but the federal government stands behind the banks. So I think that's an exaggerated fear. I worry about Europe for its own sake, and Europe is certainly having a lot of problems.
But can we learn also from the way Europe has been handling its economic problems and the way Japan has? In Europe, austerity programs have been put into place.
Yes,
and,
catastrophic
they don't seem
results.
To be working.
That's right. The European experience, if you had any
doubts. Why would
doubts,
they work here?
Well, they won't. That's the point. Not when you have a depressed economy, not when you can't offset fiscal contraction with monetary expansion, which is really where we are. And sure, if you want a really clear demonstration that austerity does in fact contract your economy, look to Greece, look to Ireland, look to Great Britain, all of which have seen austerity produce clearly negative economic results. Japan's an interesting case because they, for a long time, have alternated between expansionary policies and then pulling back. And they always pull back too soon. They always pull back before they get a serious recovery underway. But on the other hand, whenever they expand, in fact, their economy does better. And right now they have a new government, which is talking about a new round of expansionary policies. And you would think, oh, Japan has so much debt, that must be having disastrous. The markets must be panicking. In fact, the markets are cheering. In fact, it looks like even Japan, with its with gross debt of 200% of GDP, can still actually, at least it looks like it can achieve quite a lot through expansionary policies.
And it's interesting that those are occurring with a conservative in place.
Well, Japanese conservatism and American conservatism are not the same thing. But it's also, people who know Japanese politics tell me that Mr. Abe is not a good guy, that he's an old-fashioned pork barrel or tofu barrel politician. But it doesn't really matter. If he's, he may be doing the right thing for the wrong reasons, but I do believe he's doing the right thing.
You've said that you don't have any grand visions for the next 4 years.
If you have a totally obstructionist party controlling one house of Congress, it's hard to have grand visions. So the great thing about Obama's administration is that the big stuff, above all health reform, but also to a lesser extent financial reform, it's already law. And so all he has to do is safeguard those achievements, and he still is a very successful president.
What do you think about all of the Wall Streeters who have been in key posts in his government, including Timothy Geithner? Now, of course, the president has just named Mary Jo White to head the SEC. She's an accomplished prosecutor. Many people think that's great, but she also represented top Wall Street companies in private practice.
Yeah, there is this problem. I mean, to some extent, you want to appoint people who know where the bodies are buried, and sometimes that means they know where the bodies are buried because they personally put them there, and that can be a problem. I would like to have seen more leavening of the administration with people who were seriously – would challenge the preconceptions. It was upsetting that the only serious progressive economist that was ever in the administration was Jared Bernstein, and he was working for Biden, not for Obama. So that's still a disappointment, but I'm not too worked up over this latest appointment.
Just one more thing. Call a question is your use of the word entitlements, which – he feels has negative connotations. Why not substitute safety net
Yeah, probably I should. I mean, the entitlement.
But entitlement is the phrase that is used.
It has a technical It has a technical meaning. Entitlement means that Congress doesn't have to appropriate the money every year. It's already built into the system. Congress has to make a positive decision not to spend the money. But yeah, probably safety net is a good way to, or social insurance actually is the way we use it in international discussions.
Paul Krugman is the recipient of the 2008 Nobel Prize in Economics. He is a best-selling author, a columnist, and blogger for the New York Times, and a professor of economics at Princeton University. A paperback edition of his book, Endless Depression Now, has just been released by W.W. Norton with a new preface. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.